Ayatollah Khamenei, the leader of the Islamic Revolution, via video conference with the participants at the joint graduation ceremony held at the Imam Ali Military Academy.
We speak about combating oppression on the basis of rationality. Therefore, our pursuit of justice and our social activities should be based on rationality and correct calculations as well. We should not busy ourselves with peripheral matters, and we should not confuse main and trivial matters. Of course, I mentioned that one element of our national power is our defensive power, but another element consists of economic matters and economic stability and strength. The last element is cultural matters. When the issue of cultural invasion arose, we found the enemy perplexed as he entered the arena with the idea of confronting the slogan of fighting against cultural invasion. This means that the enemy feared that you might awaken and might understand that there is a cultural invasion. The same is true of economic matters.
Your light and love, all I see, nothing more I'd ever want to need. My Lord, protect me from dishonor, grant me faith to be stronger.
Of course, economic problems result from pressure. In the present time, we have certain economic and livelihood problems, all of which are resolvable. I do not believe that officials in charge of economic matters are not working hard. This is not the case, as many efforts are being made, some of which are good. Of course, there are shortcomings in the area of management capability. We acknowledge that in certain economic areas, management efficiency is poor. We have passed good bills, but they should be pursued. I said this here so that as well as our defensive power, which is one of our most important issues, economic matters receive due attention, and so that we adopt a comprehensive outlook towards all these matters. Management in all areas should be strong, active, and untiring. Whenever we had managers with these qualities, tirelessness, activeness, and enthusiasm, we witness the progress of affairs, and whenever such active and constant presence is lacking, we certainly face problems.
Alhamdulillah, alhamdulillah, all praises to Allah, all praises to Allah.
We are with you. What about you? IRIB English Radio.
Thank you.
log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
A study published in the journal Atmosphere analyzed data collected every few minutes from pollution monitors in people's homes and in total assessed 260 uses of wood burners. The results showed the burners were usually lit for about 4 hours at a time, and during this period the level of harmful particles in homes was 3 times higher than when stoves were not being used. During those 4 hours, average particle levels rose to between 27 and 195 micrograms per cubic meter of air. The World Health Organization, WHO, limit is 25 micrograms per meter cubed over 24 hours. The researchers wrote, "Epidemiologists are increasingly recognizing that exposure to high intensities of small particles over much shorter periods of time, hours rather than days, is linked to a range of health issues. They concluded it is recommended that the new residential stoves be accompanied by a health warning at the point of sale in order to indicate the health risk posed to users. The scientists said government approval schemes should also assess indoor pollution. Higher outdoor air pollution and cooking fumes were ruled out as causes of the indoor peaks. The particles are the most harmful pollutants in wood smoke, but it also contains carcinogenic chemicals, including benzene and formaldehyde. We're prepared for you an article written by Damien Carinto under the heading, "Study Finds Wood Burners 3 times Harmful at Indoor Air Pollution." The article has appeared on the front page of the Guardian.com website. Please stay with us for more of Damien Carinto's article. Scientists said wood burners triple the level of harmful pollution particles inside homes and should be sold with a health warning, also advising that they should not be used around elderly people or children. A study found that tiny particles flood into the room when the wood burner doors are opened for refueling. Furthermore, people who load in wood twice or more in an evening are expected to pollution spikes 2 or 4 times higher than those who refuel once or not at all. The particles can pass through the lungs and into the body and have been linked to a wide range of health damage, particularly in younger and older people. The research was conducted in 19 homes in Sheffield, England, over the course of a month at the start of 2020. The wood burners used were all models certified by the government as smoke-exempt appliances, meaning they produce less smoke. But this and the new eco-design standard, due to become compulsory by 2022, only assess outdoor pollution. The British government is phasing out the sale of wet wood, which produces more smoke, but the people in the study used only dry, seasoned wood. Wood and coal burning in homes is estimated to cause almost 40% of outdoor tiny particle pollution, by the new research is among the first to analyze indoor pollution in real-life settings. According to 2016 government data, almost 16% of people in the southeast of England use wood fuel, and 18% in Northern Ireland, and about 175,000 100,000 wood burners are sold annually. Rohit Chakraborty from the University of Sheffield, who led the study, said, "Our findings are a cause for concern," adding, "It is recommended that people living with those particularly susceptible to air pollution, such as children, the elderly, or the vulnerable, avoid using wood-burning stoves. If people want to use them, we recommend minimizing the time the stove is open during lighting or refueling." Rohit Chakraborty from the University of Sheffield said wood burners cause less indoor pollution than open fires, but every time you open a door, they reduce the stove to an open fire and particulate matter floods into the home. The peaks take an hour or two to dissipate, Chakraborty said, but by the time it comes down, someone opens the door again to refuel and you get spike after spike. Some burners have filters, but these only reduce the pollution being vented outside. Some people outside central heating rely on wood burners for heating of their home, and Chakraborty did not call for a ban. He said, "We should leave it to people to decide, but they should at least know what's going on, and of course, don't use it if you don't need to." The study published in the journal Atmosphere analyzed data collected every few minutes from pollution monitors in people's homes and in total assessed 260 uses of wood burners. The results showed the burners were usually lit for about 4 hours at a time, and during this period the level of harmful particles in homes was 3 times higher than when stoves were not being used. During those 4 hours, average particle levels rose to between 27 and 195 micrograms per cubic meter of air. The World Health Organization limit is 25 micrograms per meter cube of air over 24 hours. Researchers wrote, "Epidemiologists are increasingly recognizing that exposure to high intensities of small particles over much shorter periods of time, hours rather than days, is linked to a range of health issues." They concluded, "It is recommended that new residential stoves be accompanied by a health warning at the point of sale in order to indicate the health risks posed to users." The scientists said government approval schemes should also assess indoor pollution. Higher outdoor air pollution and cooking fumes were ruled out as causes of the indoor peaks. The particles are the most harmful pollutants in wood smoke, but it also contains carcinogenic chemicals including benzene and formaldehyde. James Hayden of the University of Nottingham, who was part of the study team, said, "Instead of being seen as a harmful appliance, wood-burning stoves should be recognized as having the potential for harm." He added, "Most of our participants were unaware of this, and more needs to be done to raise awareness of the health risks." 3 of the households in the study stopped using their burners after seeing their results, and another 12 took action such as refueling faster or less often, or ensuring the wood was really dry. Professor Jonathan Grigg of Queen Mary College, University of London, who led a recent report on the health effects of indoor air pollution on children for the Royal College of Physicians and Royal College of Paediatrics and Child Health, said, "There is no reason to believe that particulate matter from wood-burning stoves is less toxic than that from other sources, such as combustion of fossil fuels." He said, "This study confirms that indoor wood burners contribute significantly to indoor air pollution." He added, "It also suggests that even government-certified solid fuel stoves impair local outdoor air quality. It is therefore difficult to justify their use in any urban area." A a spokeswoman for the UK's Department of the Environment, Food and Rural Affairs, claimed air pollution has reduced significantly in recent years, with emissions of fine particulate matter falling 9% in the last decade. But we know there is more to do, and domestic burning is a major contributor. The spokesman for the UK Department of Environment said the forthcoming Environment Bill would make it easier for local authorities to enforce existing restrictions within smoke control areas. Ministers are not planning a ban on wood burners.
The Debate.
Hello and welcome to Debate. I'm Marzia Hashemi. Thanks so much for being with us. Well, relations between China and the United States continue to deteriorate. From a trade war with Washington taxing and even sanctioning some Chinese entities, to the U.S.'s promoting Taiwan as a separate nation, to Washington's Navy presence in the Taiwan Strait, have all been techniques used to pressure Beijing. Now, the waters are very murky between the two right now, and we will take a look at what the future may hold for China-U.S. ties in this debate.
The Chinese military on Saturday said it had tailed and monitored a U.S. warship as it passed through the Taiwan Strait. The military said the move deliberately raises the temperature of the Taiwan issue. It said the move jeopardizes peace and stability in the Strait. The Chinese military also accused the U.S. of using the Taiwan issue as a pawn for what it called selfish strategic purposes. The U.S. Navy, however, said its guided missile destroyer wasn't a routine mission in accordance with international law. China considers Taiwan as part of its own territory and is opposed to the increasing U.S. support for the island. Last week, the U.S. approved a new major arms sales to Taiwan in a deal worth $280 million. The package is the sixth this year and includes advanced military communications equipment. Washington says the sale aims to improve the security of Taiwan, but some analysts believe the U.S. seeks to push back against China.
The United States doesn't want to create a war over Taiwan, but is trying to push the envelope, is trying to, without breaking the one-China policy, is selling more and more arms to Taiwan, as I said, as part of the pushback against China.
Tensions have been simmering between the U.S. and China over other issues as well, from trade to the coronavirus pandemic and political developments in Hong Kong. The U.S. has also prepared a so-called entity list that mainly hits key Chinese industries over what Washington calls ties to China's military. On Thursday, the Pentagon said U.S. warships would be more assertive in responding to what it described as violations of international law. It accused China of being the most pressing long-term strategic threat. In response, China said it seeks no conflict with the U.S. and wants mutual respect and cooperation leading to a win-win outcome.
We hope that the U.S. side will take a rational and objective view of China's development of its national defense and armed forces, work with China to focus on cooperation, manage differences, and bring the China-U.S. relationship back to the right track.
The souring ties between China and the U.S. come in the wake of President Donald Trump's America First policy. With the incoming U.S. President Joe Biden set to take office on January 20th, it remains to be seen how the currently toxic relationship between the world's two biggest economies will look like. Will the new U.S. president stick to Trump's policy tools and continue the frictions? Will he try to de-escalate the tensions, or will he take a more aggressive anti-China approach?
I'd like to welcome my guests to the program, journalist and political commentator Lawrence Freeman, out of Baltimore, and political analyst Angelo Giuliano out of Montreux, Switzerland. Thank you both for being with us. So let's start this off with Lawrence. Now, Washington says Taiwan is a separate nation. China says it is part of the People's Republic of China. According to international law, it is one country with two governments. What does it all mean in your perspective?
This idea of China being one country with two governments has been accepted for many, many years. And to disrupt this political understanding is quite dangerous. The problem is that President Trump, even though he started out trying to establish friendly, cordial, amiable relations with President Xi Jinping, has deteriorated and now has adopted the geopolitical doctrine, which says that there's a zero-sum game in the world as a chessboard, and there are either winners or losers. And the United States has now determined under President Trump that it has to have hegemony and has to put down and keep under China, which is emerging as a great superpower and a very powerful economy. And this doctrine is unfortunate, and it's a problem for both the United States and China and for the world, because it can get quite dangerous, as we're seeing in your description earlier.
Well, Angelo, why does the United States want to stir up this hornet nest with China, when both, as our previous guests said, as a matter of fact, with souring relations, it would appear that both actually would suffer. So why stir up this hornet nest?
I think the USA, they know too well that Taiwan, pushing for Taiwan independence is the line not to cross, and this could be a case for war. So basically, they're using Taiwan as a pawn against China. So lately, the U.S. has invested deeply a lot into the DPP, which is the ruling party in Taiwan, and this party is advocating for independence. So China's sovereignty over Taiwan is the line not to cross, and the U.S. is trying to use this as a pawn in either to probably to go into a negotiation of the coming new reset of the new world order, which would be which a lot of things would be renegotiated, including trading and currency and debt. So I think in the best case it's a pawn for negotiation. In the worst case, it's using Taiwan for putting war in the region.
Okay, well, Lawrence, what do you think? Is the rift between the U.S. and China mostly because Washington cannot tolerate any other country except itself being on top, and China has already taken over the slot for having the largest economy, and it's threatening to surpass Washington in other fields?
Yes, well, this is a problem, because actually the U.S. interest, as an American, I know what the U.S. interests are, and the U.S. interests are not to be antagonistic to China. There are great things that the two superpowers and the two great economies, two largest economies, can accomplish in the future. So this is not in the American interest. What you have is you have an ideology best represented by people like Secretary of State Pompeo, former National Security Advisor John Bolton, and many, many others. They believe that China is a threat. It's not a threat. It can be a collaborator. It can be an ally in development in many areas, which I could outline. So this is a doctrine alien to actually what the United States stands for. We could be working with China on space and technology. We could be working with China on developing the rest of the world, including Africa. There are many areas of common interest. There is no basis for this conflict and this tension, which President Trump did not espouse when he first came into office. But unfortunately, he's given into it, and it also fits in with the prejudices of his base of supporters who are anti-China. Anti-China, China, China is not in the American interest. It's a danger to the United States. And if there ever was even the idea of decoupling the United States from China, it would be a disaster. And as our friend has reported, it is a causability for war if the United States keeps supporting Taiwan.
What about that, Angela? Do you agree with our previous guests? And if so, if it's not in the interest of the United States, whose interest is it in? Why are we seeing then this policy being implemented?
I think it's important to see who's really ruling the U.S. We have Biden and Trump being the face, but behind there are people who have the informal power, which are the military complex and the bankers. So I think it's very important to know that those are only puppets in the front, just, you know, and behind they're putting pressure because a lot of money, a lot of people are benefiting from war and from tensions, especially the military complex. So, and then I think there's a cultural problem in the U.S. because there's this culture of exceptionalism to be the best and to want to export Western culture values. And there's a deep misunderstanding of China. I personally have lived 25 years in China, and I only now start to really understand what is behind the culture and what Chinese want. And while in the U.S. there's not the slightest understanding of what China, the aspiration of China. China is not looking for hegemony, has a history of not interfering in other countries' affairs, and what it wants is prosperity for its people. That's all it wants. So there's a deep misunderstanding, and so the hawks are just using the misunderstanding and the media just to further demonize China.
Yeah, what about that, Lawrence? I mean, Angela said some interesting things there, trying to demonize China, and there's a misunderstanding culturally, and that the United States or Americans always feel that they should be number one. But on the other hand, if we look at the advances of China, especially if we look at technologically, the U.S. is actually behind China technologically, and yet there's always this image, Americans themselves, that they should be number one, they have to be the best, and it appears almost that Washington will do anything in its power to stop competition, unfortunately not in a fair way. Your take?
Unfortunately, over the last 50 years, I'm a senior citizen now, I've watched the whole process unfold. The United States culture has declined, has shrunk, and Americans don't think on the highest level these days. And Angela is correct. People don't know anything about China. If you look at Confucian philosophy, there is a alliance, a coherence between Confucian philosophy and Judeo-Western culture in the idea of the common interest of mankind. China has performed a modern-day economic miracle in lifting 750 to 800 million people out of poverty. This could be a benefit to the world. China has just brought back Chang 5 with rocks from the moon, which we can now examine, which will benefit humanity. They also have put a rover on the far side of the moon. There's many things that China is doing in science and economics, in terms of the Belt and Road and the infrastructure they're bringing to various nations of the world, including Africa. This is something that the United States has a shared interest in. It benefits all of mankind. And Angela is right. You have a military-industrial complex. You have a group of bankers, financial elite in Wall Street, in London, in Paris, who want to maintain their political power. It's financial political power. And they see China and Russia, to some extent, attempting to usurp their power. That's geopolitics. There is no zero-sum game. Great nations can work together to accomplish great things for mankind. And as an American, I would plead with my fellow Americans to start thinking more strategically, more clearly, and don't buy into the propaganda that's coming out of Pompeo and the State Department.
Well, Angelo, do you see a different foreign policy approach with China under a Biden presidency as opposed to the current U.S. administration? Or do you think we're going to continually see this clash and perhaps even greater clashing? Your assessment?
I would say in the short term, it might get better. But in the long term, it might be more inclined to go to war. I think on the form, we saw Trump as being very arrogant, using not very appropriate words, but it's only the wording, it's only a facade. I don't think, I think we need to look at facts. no matter if we like or not Trump, in the last 4 years he hasn't gone to war. While I would doubt that Biden wouldn't have his own war with China. So I think I'm very negative about Biden. Mm-hmm. I don't think he will get better.
You're saying that under a Biden administration, you feel that it's going to be more hawkish than the previous administration?
Absolutely. If you look at the cabinet and the people surrounding Biden, they come from the Obama era and also from the Bush era. And those ones, they were all criminals. All criminals. Well, if you look at what they did in Libya, in Yemen, and around the world, they're just criminals. So basically, they need wars. Those Biden needs probably his war. Every president needs his war. And I think the possibilities of war are between. It could be Iran, it could be Venezuela, or it could be China. I think it's very hard to predict, but now we can see some advanced indicators that there's a continuation of a pivot to Asia, and this is not a coincidence that we see warships in the South China Sea.
Well, Lawrence, how likely then, you've just heard, and what our other guests have said, your perspective, how likely is it that these tensions could increase and actually lead to a military confrontation under a Biden term?
I would say there is increasing possibilities that could occur. If you look at the people that President-elect Biden has picked for his cabinet, they do come from the Obama crowd, which launched the Asian pivot in early 2011 against China. They come from some of them come from the Clinton administration, and you have a loud, ignorant chorus of voices coming out of the Democratic Party leadership and the Republican Party, all in an anti-China propagandist mode. And if you look at the people that Biden has, these are people around him who have carried out regime change, who have carried out sanctions, who have carried out and escalated wars. And even though people don't like President Trump's style, and I don't like it, he has not escalated any war. And I think under the Biden administration, we should definitely be concerned that the group of people he's now putting in his government, and he himself and other leading Democrats, could well lead us into a war. It's a very dangerous situation. Unfortunately, Trump has fallen into a very bad policy advisors listening to them on China. So he's leaving the administration on a very sour note with China. And I think Biden will come in and may well escalate the antagonism between the two nations. And all it takes is a small incident somewhere in the South China Sea, and you could see the beginning of a military conflict. I'm very concerned about the Biden administration and its hawkish attitude toward China, which is already broadcast in various comments it's made. This is a serious, serious problem for us in the United States.
Angela, what about the use of sanctions? We've seen the U.S. now using sanctions to stop Chinese competition for American companies inside of the states, and they've even tried to put pressure on other countries to do the same. Do you see a continuation of this under a Biden administration, trying to block Chinese companies inside of the United States, and also making sure that Washington dictates to other countries to make sure that they also will sanction Chinese companies? How likely is that?
Absolutely. I think the direction the U.S. wants to take is towards decoupling. And I think we've seen Pompeo touring all around the world to pushing for countries to take sides, and this is a very big problem, especially in the Asian area. A lot of countries do not want to take sides. They want peace, but with the U.S., I think they will have a hard time just to have the countries to side with them. I think one of the very few countries in the region that is siding is Australia, but I don't see Japan and other countries siding for the U.S. So it's just a move to further isolate China, and I think this will not work.
And Lawrence, we're almost out of time, but your take, I mean, if you were given the opportunity to actually advise the new American administration that's going to take over in a couple of weeks, what would you say? What would be the way that the United States should be handling foreign relations with China?
I think the United States should recognize we have a common interest with China. As the two economic powerhouses in the world, there are many positive things we can do together. For example, space. Exploring space is one of the most important developments for mankind, to learn the laws of the universe, to discover them for all the benefit of mankind. We should also use China's Belt and Road and their elimination of poverty. I'm an African specialist, and we have 600 million people without electricity in Africa, 400 million people living in poverty. If the United States and China combined their forces and their outlook together and their powers, we could eliminate poverty in Africa and other parts of Southeast Asia. These are the kinds of wonderful things that could be done together. We could develop nuclear power, fusion energy, which has been on the drawing board for a half a century. All these things are possible when powers like the United States and China would collaborate for the better beneficial development of mankind.
Okay.
And this is what I represent, and this is what the United States should be.
Angela, your take. Do you think that China would actually be willing, you've just heard our other guests discuss the way forward, if he had an opportunity to tell the United States, do you think that China, Beijing, would be willing to cooperate and work with the Americans?
Absolutely. Beijing is looking every opportunity to reconcile with the U.S. He wants to share a future with the U.S. It's not either China or the U.S. They want to work for multiple world, and I think this is a China becoming the largest superpower, or just getting to the level of the U.S. I think it's a huge opportunity for the world. It's an opportunity just to go from a unipolar world to a multipolar world. It's an opportunity to get out of the American hegemony and the neocolonialism, because we are still half of the world is colonized. If you look at the impact, the pressure the U.S. is putting in South America and in Africa, I think with China would be very different. China could give back dignity to the greater South and could help in decolonize the world, but this is obviously what the U.S. doesn't want.
Okay.
I am for peace. I like very much what our colleague just said before. I am for peace. I think we have huge opportunities. But there are some evil forces that do not think the same as we do. And those evil forces are people, the bankers, and whoever is ruling now the U.S. And it's
okay. Unfortunately, I am out of time, but I appreciate both of you being with us for this debate. Journalist and political commentator Lawrence Freeman out of Baltimore, and political analyst Angela Giuliano out of Montreux, Switzerland. Appreciate both of you being with us, and as always, we appreciate you being with us on another debate. I'm Marzia Hashemi, signing off for myself and all the crew right here in Tehran. Hope to see you next time.
The bustle of life. The sound of living. Only sound will endure.
Hello.
IRIB English Radio. in the limelight.
Much of California has exhausted its usual ability to staff intensive care beds for treating coronavirus patients, and US's most populated state is desperately searching for 3,000 temporary medical workers to meet demand. State officials are reaching out to foreign partners in places like Australia and Taiwan amid a shortage of temporary medical workers in the United States, particularly nurses trained in critical care. Dr. Janet Kaufman, a professor of public policy at the University of California, San Francisco, said, "We're now in a situation where we have surges all across the country, so nobody has many nurses to spare." California hospitals typically turn to staffing agencies during flu season, when they rely on travel nurses to meet patient care needs. For example, it is the only state in the United States with strict nurse-to-patient ratios, requiring hospitals to provide one nurse for every two patients in intensive care and one nurse for every four patients in emergency rooms. However, those ratio requirements are being waived at many hospitals in California as the coronavirus cases surge. But according to San Diego-based healthcare staffing from Aya Healthcare, the pool of available travel nurses is drying up as demand for them jumped to 44% over the last month, with California, Texas, Florida, New York, and Minnesota requesting the most extra staff. Stay with us for an article written by Daisy Nguyen and Don Thompson. The piece is titled, "California Desperately Searches for More Nurses and Doctors." The article was published by the Associated Press News Agency. Since the coronavirus pandemic took hold in the United States, Sarah Howes has been on the road, going from one hospital to another to care for COVID-19 patients on the brink of death. A cardiac intensive care nurse from Washington, D.C., with expertise in heart rhythm, airwave, and pain management, her skills are in great demand as infections and hospitalizations skyrocket nationwide. Sarah Howes is among more than 500 nurses, doctors, and other medical staff California has brought in and deployed to hospitals that are running out of capacity to treat the most severe COVID-19 cases. Her six-week assignment started on Monday, 21st of December, in San Bernardino, about 60 miles east of Los Angeles, and she anticipates working 14-hour shifts with a higher-than-usual caseload. San Bernardino County has 1,545 people in hospital, and more than 125 are in makeshift surge beds, which are being used because regular hospital space isn't available. Sarah Howes said, "I expect patients to die. That's been my experience. They die, I put them in body bags, the room gets cleaned, and then another patient comes in." Much of California has exhausted its usual ability to staff intensive care beds, and the nation's most populated state is desperately searching for 3,000 temporary medical workers to meet demand. California state officials are reaching out to foreign partners in places like Australia and Taiwan amid a shortage of temporary medical workers in the United States, particularly nurses trained in critical care. California's Governor Gavin Newsom said the state has relationships with countries that provide aid during crises such as wildfires. Dr. Janet Kaufman, a professor of public policy at the University of California, San Francisco, said, "We're now in a situation where we have surges all across the country, so nobody has many nurses to spare." California hospitals typically turn to staffing agencies during flu season when they rely on travel nurses to meet patient care. For example, it is the only state in the United States with strict nurse-to-patient ratios, requiring hospitals to provide one nurse for every two patients in intensive care and one nurse for every four patients in emergency rooms. However, those ratio requirements are being waived at many California hospitals as coronavirus cases surge. But according to San Diego-based healthcare staffing firm Aya Healthcare, the pool of available travel nurses is drying up as demand for them jumped to 44% over the last month. But California, Texas, Florida, New York, and Minnesota requesting the most extra staff. Aya Healthcare is one of two companies contracted by California to fulfill hospital staffing requests. Sophia Morris, Vice President of Account Management at Aya Healthcare, said, "We are hiring like crazy and working insane hours." Dr. Mark Galli, California's Health and Human Services Secretary, said the state is getting two-thirds of its requests for travel nurses fulfilled right now. It's a sharp contrast from the spring, where Governor Newsom ordered the nation's first stay-at-home order. As infection rates slowed and hospitals voluntarily suspended elective surgeries for weeks, healthcare providers from California flew to New York to help their overworked colleagues. Jan Emerson Shear, a spokeswoman for the California Hospital Association, said this time many hospitals are postponing procedures that are not emergencies. California also has opened alternative care facilities for people with less serious illnesses to save hospital beds for the sickest patients. Dr. Kaufman said that also means hospitals have fewer nurses to deploy to intensive care units from other units, adding, "And many healthcare workers became infected or have had to quarantine because they were exposed to someone with COVID-19 during the surge." Another factor is a dip in the number of nurses 60 years old and older. Joanne Spetz, the University of California, San Francisco's Health Force Center Associate Director of Research, said in a survey of the state's 320,000 registered nurses, many older nurses told researchers at the center that they stopped working out of concern for their or their own family's health. Sarah House, a 50-year-old, said she's able to travel to work because her twin sons are in college, but not without contracting a mild case of COVID-19 somewhere along the way. On Monday, 21st of December, more than 17,000 people were hospitalized with confirmed COVID-19 infections, more than double the previous peak reached in July. An estate model that uses current data to forecast future trends shows the number could reach nearly 100,000 by January. More than 3,600 COVID-19 patients were in intensive care units. Dr. Mark Futernick, an emergency room physician in Los Angeles, who is on the board of the California chapter of the American College of Emergency Physicians, helped set up a Los Angeles surge hospital last spring. Now he's fielding texts and phone calls asking when it will reopen. He said, "The surge hospital is not going to open again. There would be no way to staff it." Dr. Mark Galli, head of the California State Health and Human Services, said entire areas of California may run out of room, even in surge capacity units, by the end of the month and early in January. It's trying to avoid that by opening makeshift hospitals in places like gymnasiums, in tents, and a vacant NBA arena, and sending patients to parts of the state with empty beds. California's Governor Gavin Newsom this spring sought to reinforce fatigued medical workers by creating a paid volunteer California Health Corps, and he touted the many thousands who signed up. But with cases skyrocketing now, just 28 members are working at 13 facilities. The number has dwindled even after California Governor Gavin Newsom made repeated appeals for more retired medical professionals to sign up. The state is updating its planning guide for how hospitals would ration care if everyone can't get the treatment that they need. A document recently circulated among doctors at the four hospitals run by Los Angeles County calls for them to shift strategy. Instead of trying everything to save a life, their goal during the crisis is to save as many patients as possible. That means those less likely to survive won't get the same kind of care offered in normal times. Sarah Howes said her online community of nurses is offering webinars about moral distress because many of them have had to change the way they care for patients. She said, "The patients that aren't yet intubated, and even the ones intubated, aren't getting the kind of nursing care that I want to give them because our resources are so limited and time is taxed." She added, "It's really disheartening."
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran,